Right now it is time for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. That's right, Arthur joins us on a Monday morning. We talk food, glorious food, and it's always a highlight of my day and week. What a way to start off the week. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning. As anyone who listens to this program must know, I just came back from Italy. I was thrilled to be there, but I'm even more thrilled to be home.
That's right.
and the revelation, I mean, this is not really a revelation because I knew this for a long time, but there's no food in Rome that I can't make myself or find in Brooklyn. So I can live like a Roman while living in Brooklyn. Which reminds me, I haven't spoken to this woman in many years, but I had a friend named Sharon Sanders who wrote a book called Cooking Up a Life. Cooking Up an Italian Life. And she lived in New Jersey, and she was able, even 20, 25 years ago, when she wrote this book, to be able to eat like an Italian. Things have gotten better. While I was in Rome, I was trying to think of what ingredients here, other than locally made salumi, let's discount that, okay? Although I can get very good salumi, that means, you know, cold cuts in English, in Brooklyn, but not the same. But with very few exclusions, I can buy almost everything I need to have a Roman kitchen in Brooklyn. Now, when I say Roman, you know, it's funny because when I was very young and started reading about Italian food, even before probably I got to Italy ever, which was in the, I guess, around 1970 was my first trip. So was that 52 years ago? I always read that there was no cuisine in Rome. There was no such thing as cucina romana, that it was all borrowed from other places. It's totally not true. Totally not true. There is a very distinctive Roman cuisine. It includes a sort of pantheon of pastas, and no alliteration really intended. And it's centered on what's called the fifth quarter, meaning when you slaughter an animal, and then you talk about the hind quarters and the fore quarters. Well, the fifth quarter is the innards, and they're very big eaters of innards in Rome. One of the things I cannot buy in anywhere that I know of in New York is baby, really, suckling lamb's intestines, which are still filled with mother's milk. These are called paiata in Rome. I don't know anywhere else. Probably in lamb country, like in Calabria. They grow fabulous lamb in Calabria. They probably eat that too, but I've never eaten it in Calabria. But in Rome, you can get it in a trattoria. A good trattoria will have the real deal. Your average trattoria or tourist place might not have the real deal, figuring you're not going to want to eat the real deal because, you know, it is sort of gross to a tourist. Anyway, not to me. I had my bowl full at a very good local restaurant near my friend Iris's house, and it was perfect. So that's one thing about Roman cuisine, and I'll get to the pastas in a minute. The other thing is, and lamb is the chief meat, I would say, and pork and lamb, not beef, in Rome. And one of the things I can't get in New York is, well, I can. I'm going to talk to my butcher about this. I'm sure I can. I'll pay through the nose for it. But it's young lamb. Lamb so young that it's not really red meat yet. And that every which part of that is used in Rome. Because it is a cuisine, around shepherds. So not only do shepherds have the animal, but they also have the milk. And one of the specialties of Rome is sheep's milk ricotta. Now, fact is, I can buy that in New York. I know that Di Paolo used to be delivering on Wednesday or Thursday. But if you call Di Paolo, which is the best salumeria in New York City, I guess it's on Mott Street, on the corner of Mott Street, or is it Mulberry? I never remember. And Grand. It's been there since the 1920s, and it is owned by the third generation, who maybe there's a fourth generation. There is a fourth generation. The fourth generation is next door to the main store with the wine shop. Anyway, they have Di Paolo brings in sheep's milk ricotta from Rome. And so Paiata I can't guess, but you know, how often do I need to eat that? Like, you know, once every 5 years is enough. I have trouble getting a baby lamb, but if I talk to my butcher, I bet maybe it may be too late now. But I would think that around Easter time, that's not a hard thing to get, because a lot of our Mediterranean peoples here in New York eat lamb for Easter, young lamb. And that's about it. So I came home. I cooked at Iris's one night. Interesting. She asked me to make the amatriciana because I'm not bragging here, but I am known for making a particularly good amatriciana, which is very Roman. And we had some friends from New York for dinner that night. And I shouldn't say we. Iris had us and these other friends from New York for dinner. And the other friend from New York, who has my cookbooks, but hasn't seen me in 30 years, wanted to watch me cook. So I made amatriciana, and I got to use the best Roman pancetta, the best pancetta you could buy in Rome, because Iris buys only the best of everything. Sidebar, I have to laugh. We were talking tuna fish one day, and canned tuna fish one day, and she said, well, I only buy the absolute best tuna fish. It's very expensive, but I splurge because it's so good, and I do love tuna fish. And she brings out a jar of Calipo tuna fish, the same tuna fish that I buy in Brooklyn. Calipo, Calipo. It's around. I buy it from Coluccio, but you don't have to go there to buy it because they're the importers. It's a brand from Calabria. The Coluccio family is from Calabria originally. few generations ago. Anyway, and I think I have to look at my... I'm out of it right now, and I need to go to Calucha to buy some, and I have to see what I pay, but I don't think I'm paying any more for mine than Iris was paying in Rome. It's a different size jar. But anyway, we're talking about the best pancetta from my amatriciana and great canned tomatoes, pretty much, I would say, on par with what I have to spend a fortune for, but you don't in Italy. When I say a fortune, canned San Marzano tomatoes are now up to $5 a can, sometimes more. And I haven't seen them on sale in a long time either. And when I do, I buy a bunch because I go through them fairly quickly. Anyway, so I made my amatriciana, and the New Yorkers said, can we do this in New York? And I said, absolutely, you know, go to Di Paolo, which they do, by the way, they're regular Di Paolo customers, and get the best pancetta. I buy a pancetta. It's all about, let me say, this dish, which is just tomatoes and pancetta, a tiny bit of olive oil to get the thing going. Also, I put in, this is controversial, but I put some onion in mine. So what I do is I start out by rendering the the pork products. In Rome, by the way, many people would make this with guanciale, which is the very fatty pork jowls that are cured like bacon. Pancetta is the cut that we call bacon, and it's just cured with salt and pepper. And the one I buy in Brooklyn, the commercial one that I buy, is excellent, and I would say equivalent to what Iris gets in Rome at her fancy store, and she doesn't even go to the regular market for that. And I can also buy guanciale in my local supermarkets. They have it. There's a demand for it here in Brooklyn, so I guess that's why they carry it. But I also get some illegal pancetta from time to time. I can't even say who makes it. But somebody I know makes pancetta in his basement. And it's extraordinary, what can I say? But he was afraid. He was selling it to friends and family. And then he thought, oh, I might get caught, and this is really a serious jail sentence. So I haven't gotten it in a while, but he claims he's going to make it again. You know, when it cools down for illegal pancetta. So, you know, pancetta is the essential ingredient here. And Amatriciana is after a place called Amatrice, which is actually not in near Rome. It's in the mountains. It's a pork place. So that's sort of people will argue that Amatriciana is a borrowed sauce. But listen, every trattoria in Rome makes it. And some places they just list, you know, they'll make the pantheon of pastas, which is the Amatriciana, which is tomato, pancetta, could be a little onion. Some people even put a little white wine in there. I don't do that. I do add hot pepper, depending on my audience, a little or even a lot. Carbonara, which Americans think is a cream sauce, but has no cream in it. It's just bacon and eggs that with cheese, and the eggs are the thickener and the sauce-making thing here. Then there's alla gricia, which is not very known in the States, although I'm sure it has creeped into some of the trendy Italian menus in Manhattan. I have not seen it in a long time, but gricia is just the pancetta or guanciale, and cheese. That's it. Cacio e pepe is the most difficult to make. Sounds like the simplest, too. But by the way, alla gricia is sometimes called amatriciana in bianco because it's the ingredients of an amatriciana but no tomatoes. So it's a coating more than a sauce. And cacio e pepe should be more a coating than a sauce. And it's difficult because you've got to beat pecorino. By the way, all of these traditionally would be made with pecorino, sheep's milk cheese. I told you it's a cuisine all about sheep. And the cheese is generally, it could be the salty kind that we buy here. Locatelli is the big, big brand here. And I find that's a really good pecorino. Nice, strong, salty pecorino. But there are milder pecorinos, too. Anyway, and you can find those around in the States as well. But cacio e pepe is tricky because you've got to take the pasta cooking water, which has, you know, starch in it, and make a creamy sauce with just cheese and pepper, with just pecorino cheese and freshly ground black pepper, not hot pepper. And I must say, the most extraordinary version of this I had on this last trip, but it really it wasn't on pasta. It was on fried gnocchi. And we ordered a platter of this, Iris, Bob, and me, and we could not finish it. Well, we ordered too much food that day. But that was the thing we could not finish because it was so rich. I must say, I found it irresistible when I started eating it, but I got saturated quickly. It's a very rich sauce. And artichokes are, you know, very Roman. And we caught the very end of the season for artichokes in Rome, and the height of the season for fava beans. And nowadays, didn't used to be, things do change even in Italy. Nowadays, you can buy, you know, full fat asparagus at the market in Rome. Whereas in the old days, you could only get the skinny, and I mean skinny, not pencil thin, thinner than that, wild asparagus, which I have to say don't have a whole lot of flavor. I like the whole idea of it. I think unless you're making, you don't eat them for a vegetable in their own sake. It's something you would put on pasta or make risotto with, in large enough quantity. Of course, it gives up flavor. But our fat asparagus are a sort of new thing to be so common in Italy. Anyway, so Iris made, and I have now made several times because we're living like Romans in Brooklyn. And the season is now here in New York, and was the end in Rome. I'm making vignarola. And by the way, there is a I didn't even look at my own. I have a recipe for vignarola in the Southern Italian Table, I'm pretty sure. And it's a, you know, as we used to say in food writing, a medley of vegetables. Now, in Rome, right now, you would be making this because it's the tail end of spring. And the artichokes are at their tail end, and the good seasonal Roman artichokes, the ones you get fried a la Judea, which is deep fried and crispy, but also melt in your mouth. And then the more typical Roman preparation, which is alla Romana, carciofi alla Romana, artichokes in the Roman style, which is to say cooked with olive oil, garlic, and a particular kind of mint called mentuccia. You know, I ate some raw mentuccia, and when it's a tiny, tiny leafed kind of mint. In fact, it almost looks like large thyme. It doesn't really look like mint. It looks more like thyme. And it really does have a very pointed flavor. However, I've been using other mints here in New York. So another one of the things you really can't get in Brooklyn is mentuccia. Although somebody told me, and I don't know, maybe I should look this up better, that it's catnip. I don't know. Anybody who grows catnip, tell me, does it have a strong mint aroma? I don't think so. Anyway, so the artichokes are braised with garlic, mint, and I like parsley. In fact, what I do here in Brooklyn is I do mine with parsley, garlic, and for the mint flavor, a couple of pinches of dried mint, which I always keep in the house because I use it in other Mediterranean foods. And also, I find dried mint lasts a long time, longer than other sweet herbs when they're dried. It's a good dried herb. It has a very strong flavor, so you use it judiciously. In any case, so I chop up parsley, let's say a half a cup of parsley leaves with a large clove of garlic, and on my board I chop it all up together until I either get tired of chopping or it's fine enough. And I put that in a deep skillet with a cover, that has a cover, with a coating of olive oil on the bottom of the pan. I use good olive oil, you know, so I think it's important here is to use your best, well, maybe not your absolute best, but a good, really good extra virgin olive oil. It's one of the main flavors here, so you gotta like it. And heat that up until the garlic and the herbs start sizzling, and then throw in your artichoke hearts. Now, artichoke hearts. So you go to the market in Rome, and you say, I want a kilo of artichokes, that's 2.2 pounds of artichokes, or whatever amount you want, give me five artichokes. They'll clean them for you. The owner of the stand that Iris shops at, her son stands there, and he's a pro, of course. He's not a little boy either. He's a teenager or maybe in his early 20s. He stands there and he cleans the artichokes, meaning he takes off all the outer leaves. He cuts off the tops. For some strange reason, we talked about this at the market, they don't go, they don't oxidize very quickly, so that he trims it all up. These have no chokes, so he doesn't have to dig in and get a choke out. It's a variety of artichoke that I wish we had, because I could see how I would be easily cleaning these up, and they leave the stems on. And usually you cook the artichokes with the stems up in a deep pan that you can cover with the herb and the garlic. I don't know anybody who uses onion, but I wouldn't be surprised. But I think that garlic, mint, and parsley is perfect. And some liquid. In the case of, you know, if you're doing whole artichokes, you're going to have to put in at least a quarter of an inch of water. Or I don't like white wine with artichokes, but with just plain old water, maybe a half an inch of water, and cover the pot and let them steam until they're tender. So the problem in Brooklyn is that I don't get artichokes like that. And so I decided last week to try frozen artichoke hearts, which I admit I bought at Whole Foods, and it's the Whole Foods brand, which is called 365, as in you could buy these every day. And I just made another batch with them yesterday. They're great. I really think they, you know, after they cook the way I'm going to tell you how to cook them in a Vignarola, they're every bit as good as the ones that Iris cooked in Rome. Although I have to say, Iris kept apologizing that this was the tail end of the artichoke season, and so they were going to be a little tough. And you know what? The frozen artichoke hearts, some of them were not trimmed all that well, and they could be a little tough. But I can deal with it. Artichokes are a very low-carbohydrate, high-fiber vegetable. And if they weren't so tedious to prepare, I would be doing it much more frequently. When the so-called baby artichokes, which are not baby artichokes, but the offshoot artichokes, come into season a little bit later in the season, I probably will end up cooking those. I even like to make my own marinated artichoke hearts with those. But now I'm going to try making marinated artichoke hearts with the frozen artichoke hearts. So to make a vignarola, which Bob and I are just loving, and this is enough for more than two people, but the two of us can eat it twice. You probably can get six servings out of this. A 12-ounce bag of frozen artichoke hearts. Now, I'm not saying there aren't other brands that are good. There probably are. I just haven't tried them. Years and years ago, I mean many years ago, I used to make frozen artichoke hearts poached in butter with a little garlic. I loved those. What I mean was I melted too much butter in the bottom of a pan, put in the artichoke hearts, buttered a piece of wax paper, put that over the salt and pepper on the artichoke hearts, chopped garlic, put the buttered wax paper over the top, covered the pot, and cooked it over extremely low heat until they were tender. I might have to do that again. So I put in the parsley and garlic and a couple pinches of dried mint in my good olive oil, and then I added the 12-ounce bag of defrosted frozen artichoke hearts, and they have, of course, moisture clinging to them, which is enough moisture. Toss them around in the oil, put the pan on very low, cover the pan, and let them cook for about 10 minutes or so. You know, you're going to have to figure this out. I did 10 minutes, maybe it was 12 minutes, I timed it yesterday. It was 10 or 12 minutes. And at that point, and they were sizzling nicely. In my pan over low heat, they were sizzling, and they did give up some moisture. I added the next ingredient, which was asparagus. Now, as I started to say, in Rome, it didn't used to be that you could get the nice, you know, fat asparagus, but Iris had them, and she used them, so I got permission to use them, even though I gave myself permission years ago. So I washed the asparagus, and I cut off the bottoms. I just cut them off. You know, usually I snap where it starts to break, but in this case, they're going to cook for a bit, so even a little tough bottom gets tender enough. So I don't worry about it. And they were beautiful, fresh asparagus from New Jersey. And I cut off the bottoms, and I cut into about inch and a half lengths, including the tips, the rest of the spears, and I put that in with whatever water was clinging to it from washing it into the pan with the artichoke hearts, stirred that around, and that cooked for about 15 minutes. I peeked in the pot a couple times and stirred it around, but after about 15 minutes, except for the occasional tough leaf of artichoke, the artichokes were very tender, and the asparagus were fully tender. And if you need to add a little bit of water, you can, but I didn't need to. Just enough moisture exuded from the vegetables to cook them in their own juices. And then the final vegetable, in my case, was peas, frozen peas, the petit peas. And for 12 ounces of artichoke hearts, I used 3 cups, I measured it, of cut-up asparagus. That was one big bunch of asparagus. But 2.5 to 3 cups of asparagus cut up, and then 1 cup of peas. Now, the peas, I've discovered, do not have to cook, really. I put the peas in with the hot other vegetables, stirred them around, and turned off the heat and just let it sit until we were ready to eat this. And then I reheated it ever so slightly, just to warm it through, and the peas were perfect. They really don't have to be cooked. Frozen peas don't have to be cooked very much. And the only reason I cooked frozen artichoke hearts as long as I did, in fact, a total of 25 minutes, if you count it after I put in the asparagus, is because they are very fibrous. And most people don't want to bite into a tough leaf. So that's the vignarola, wonderful, wonderful side dish. We ate it for its own sake with hard-boiled eggs last night. I think it's great to go with lamb. You can, leftovers, tossed with pasta. Never hurt. With leftovers last week, I made a frittata, which we enjoyed immensely. In that case, because I had a few mushrooms use up, I sliced up the few mushrooms, maybe it was about 5 or 6 mushrooms, and I sautéed them first, and I added that to the vignarola, and then I made a frittata with the vignarola. Gotta say, mushrooms are a very good addition to a vignarola, and I was thinking mushrooms even would make a good side dish if you want to do something vegan, which everybody should have. I think at this point everybody needs to have one vegan meal in them. You could make some nice mushrooms. I mean, you may get a variety of different mushrooms and put them in the oven with some oiled breadcrumbs. And you've got a nice sort of, you know, vegetarians always like to say that mushrooms are their meat. So that with a vignarola, very good combination.
Mushrooms are great. You know what? I make mushroom chili, and you just chop them up, and you put them in with your own chili sauce and with tomatoes and with onions and peppers and stuff like that. And by the time it's all cooked down, you can't tell that it's not meat. You just can't. It's amazing.
Well, yeah. You know, they are the vegetarians. I get being a vegetarian, totally. However, I don't get vegan.
No.
I don't get what's wrong with chickens that will lay eggs whether we want them to or not. What's wrong with their eggs? And, you know, what's wrong with an animal's milk and the products you can make from the milk? The fact is we have bred these animals to give a lot of milk, and if they don't give their milk, they're going to be in pain. I learned that when I worked on a dairy farm as a teenager, that the cows would come to be milked in the afternoon because if they didn't get milk, they'd be in pain. At least that's what my farmer told me.
All right, Arthur.
All right. Another week of living like a Roman in Brooklyn.
I love it. I'll speak to you next week, Arthur.
Bye.
Take care. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven on Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com on the web.